UTC right after the international news.
Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you for joining me. This week,
Sisterhood! Sisterhood! Hear my voice!
We'll look at the power of the global Me Too movement. What effect has it had on African societies?
To be a woman is not a crime!
Across the continent, survivors of sexual harassment and abuse are taking to the streets and social media in movements that have predated and outlasted the peak of the global Me Too movement. But has anything changed in the way sexual violence is addressed and prosecuted in African countries? We'll also bring you a new report by Human Rights Watch about domestic violence during the COVID-19 pandemic and how lockdowns have put women and children at greater risk. We'll examine all that and more. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Before we begin, we'd like to inform you that some of the themes we discuss this week are of a sensitive nature and might not be appropriate for children. Agnes Tirop was a celebrated Olympic long-distance runner in her home country of Kenya. So imagine that nation's shock and grief when the 25-year-old athlete was found stabbed to death in her home on October 13th. Days later, police arrested Tirop's husband, Emmanuel Rotich, in connection with a crime. Police say he was trying to flee the country. Tirop's death comes shortly after Human Rights Watch released a report documenting a rise in domestic violence during the COVID-19 lockdowns in Kenya. In the report titled, "I Had Nowhere to Go," women recounted their experiences on video. The report also evaluates the government's response and services to prevent gender-based violence and offer survivors help during the pandemic. Here is a video excerpt from that report.
He used to take advantage during the lockdown because he knew I couldn't go anywhere. He beat me up so badly, something that he was used to doing. That day, I thought he was going to severely hurt me because he kept saying he will kill me one day.
Gender-based violence has become a national disaster in this nation, and therefore it needs to be dealt with as a national disaster. When COVID came, it came with that component of social distance. If you are in a situation where the husband is the one who is working, now he uses the power, which is having the money, to now manipulate or abuse this other person. So home became danger in the sense that you are forced in one way or the other to be with the perpetrator with limited options. We were supporting so many clients who were going through GPV. When you're having around 1,500 cases, that's already triple the number compared to 2019. It's the government's responsibility to take care of its people. Violence as a way of affecting somebody's mental well-being to a point of sometimes even making smaller decisions becomes very difficult. So by the time a woman is deciding to come out of an abusive relationship, there's need to be a lot of support.
I made a decision to leave. I went to the hospital and then went directly to the police station.
We went to the chief because we refused to see our fellow women being battered. We said we want to go around teaching and sensitizing our women to the problem. Those in government, all they do is talk. We want the government to intervene, because personally, it's overwhelming.
That That video accompanied Human Rights Watch's report titled I Had Nowhere to Go. I spoke to the producer of this video, Audrey Kawire Wabwire from Human Rights Watch in Kenya, about the details and the main themes of the report. Audrey, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Please tell us, what does this report by Human Rights Watch aim to show us?
Thanks so much for having me. The report is based on interviews with 30 people, activists, survivors, people in the media, others working in NGOs. And they spoke about their experiences and their work during the lockdowns last year. There was media reports about gender-based violence, about high numbers of teen pregnancies in Kenya last year. And Human Rights Watch looked into research, particularly on gender-based violence. And the findings were that among the survivors, many of the survivors did not have somewhere to go, as the report title states. There was nowhere for them to go to get medical assistance and just other social support that they needed at this very difficult time. So we talked to people who were, you know, sexually assaulted or beaten in their homes by relatives, family members, neighbors, other close people, and even strangers in the community. And when this happened to them during, let's say, normal times before the pandemic, it was possible to go to a friend's home or a relative's home or escape to somewhere in the community. But now, because there was a lockdown and the government did not want people to, you know, move around so much to prevent the spread of the virus, people were actually, survivors were locked in the home and they had to stay sometimes with their abusers, which is a really difficult environment, of course. And many survivors we spoke to did not feel free to report to the police just because of, you know, feeling like there was so much corruption and interference with the investigation, particularly in small communities. And so they did not want to go to the police. The police are not always sensitive to survivors of gender-based violence. And so this is just one barrier they faced in getting justice. They could not really go to health centers and hospitals because, remember, during the lockdowns, especially when the pandemic had just started, the capacities for most health centers and hospitals was really limited because they were dealing with the pandemic. And so having to face all this violence and not really having somewhere to go for counseling or to get first aid, medical care, this was a really tough spot that survivors of gender-based violence were put in last year, even as the pandemic continues.
And Audrey, just to give viewers an idea of how bad it can get in a short space of time, I was reading in this report that according to Kenya's National Crime Research Center, the number of gender-based violence cases increased by 87%. In 3 months, and that was just during April to June of last year. Of course, it all happened while the COVID restrictions and lockdowns were in place in the country. And so, Audrey, just confirm for us, these are just the cases that we know of, right, that have been reported and where women have come forward and their stories have been documented in some way or form.
These numbers, these high numbers that we are reading about are the cases that, you know, actually go to the police and are documented in some way. But most of the people we spoke to did not feel comfortable going to the police. There's so many beliefs and experiences that deter them from going to report. And one NGO that has a gender-based violence hotline said they saw a 300% increase in reports just between 2019 and 2020 during the pandemic. And, you know, these are people who can access a phone, who know that this hotline exists. So you can imagine how many more there are who just do not have access to these facilities and also don't feel safe going to report. So it is a widespread problem.
And so, Audrey, given the work that you and your team do at Human Rights Watch, why do you think this is not as high a priority for governments in general? Why does there appear to be this lack of urgency when in many countries, especially on the continent, women make up 50%, even more than half of a particular country's population? That's failing half your country.
Well, I think there's a lack of political will to listen to what women are saying, because women are speaking up. And even when they're not speaking up, we read so many reports last year of people who could hear what was happening to their neighbors or who could see what was happening. But our leadership is just not ready or willing to address this problem fully. You know, it's one thing for the president to go to an international conference and say, you know, gender is a very important thing to Kenya and, you know, we're taking all these steps. But in a small county in Western Kenya, in Narok, where I spent some time early this year, the community activists are just working alone. They're just keeping people in their homes. So if indeed we are coming to the world stage to say that, you know, all these issues are important to us, then why not take the actual steps to listen to all these survivors who need urgent help right now? So I think mainly it's a problem of political will, because there are laws that have been passed, there are policies that have been passed, there are trainings that are happening for police. Then I think it just takes that extra step for the leaders to now say that, you know, we have all these great initiatives, how are we rolling them out? During the last election cycles, when there was violence in Kenya, there were also cases of gender-based violence, which Human Rights Watch documented. And each time the government has sometimes acknowledged that the problem exists, but taking the extra step to actually support survivors, to actually help them get maybe healthcare or other social support that they need, the government has failed on this. While Kenya has passed laws and policies regarding gender-based violence, this pandemic really tested these mechanisms and showed that, you know, there's actually no support. There's nowhere for women to go or girls to go when they are faced this kind of abuse. They require shelters, and there were no shelters for people to go. And they resorted to going to activists' homes, and the activists were basically taking care of them at their home with their money, their food. This is something the government should have been doing. The government should have made sure by now that after all this training that the police have done, they are able to receive survivors of violence and take care of them and make sure that they are not even going back to abusive environments, or to show that they're actually arresting and taking all these cases right to the end. But this did not happen, and this is a big failure of the government right now.
Now, Audrey, for someone who is looking to get out of an abusive situation, but who perhaps doesn't know where to go, what to do next, or even really what their rights are and how to exercise those, from the work that you do, what kind of advice or guidance would you give them?
There are community activists who are working every day, day and night, to just help women understand what their rights are and where they can go, and that they have the option to report. Now, reporting is very difficult, and even getting out of an abusive environment is very difficult, but just to have the knowledge that whatever's happening to them is wrong is quite important. But I do feel that this question that, you know, what can women do? I feel like women are doing a lot more than they were in the past, and there's much more access to information. But apart from knowing what you can do, you do need the support to leave a difficult environment, and that support needs to come from the government. So this responsibility lies with the government more than it does not lie with the women at all. People need to know that they can go somewhere, they can get out of their abusive home, they can go somewhere to get healthcare and counseling, and, you know, to stay just away from all the horrific things that they've gone through. So as much as they know, the government does have the major responsibility here to take care of all survivors.
Audrey Kawire Wabwire from Human Rights Watch in Nairobi, Kenya. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, and have a good rest of your day.
Many survivors of domestic and sexual violence often hesitate to come forward, let alone open a case, because of stigma. They worry they won't be believed, that they'll be blamed, ridiculed, ostracized, or even attacked again. In Africa, research and recent examples show how society, the media, and social media can perpetuate a culture of victim blaming. In September, a so-called rape demonstration on television in Côte d'Ivoire sparked outrage. TV host Yves Dembella encouraged a convicted rapist to use a mannequin to demonstrate how he attacked his victims, as Kadir Traoré simulated his techniques for, quote, a successful rape. The show host asked if Traoré's victims enjoyed it. The two men then offered women advice on how to avoid getting raped. Amid a nationwide backlash, a court convicted both the host and his guest for glorifying rape. Dembella was fined about $3,600 and Traoré was sentenced to 2 years in prison. In South Africa, which has one of the world's highest rates of rape and femicide, studies show that those who report incidents to police are often re-traumatized. They experience victim blaming, threats, and their cases are often delayed or botched. Look at this study from Nigeria, which shows victim blaming is flourishing in Africa's most populous nation. It says a national survey found that nearly 25% of women aged 18 to 24 years experienced sexual abuse before age 18, and that survivors are often blamed for indecent dressing and keeping the wrong company, others for being careless or walking alone. Then last year, the University of Nairobi came under fire for victim blaming a female student who had reportedly been raped by a gang of men. In the memo, campus security accused the woman, who says she was attacked while walking home at night, of recklessness. After more than 6,000 people signed an online petition asking the university to blame the male perpetrators and not the woman survivor, the university apologized. Now, today, our show features mostly women activists and survivors speaking out about victim blaming and how they are often met with more questions than support in their communities. We also asked men in South Africa and Kenya if they think survivors of sexual abuse and assault are supported in their communities.
So I think that in the last couple of years, we've made big strides, and I think there's a lot more support for women who come forward with sexual assault allegations or stories. I think the Me Too movement has had a big impact that's been on a global stage, but it's filtered down into South Africa. I think in South Africa, though, we have, you know, terrible stats when it comes to rape and sexual assault. So I think that as South Africans, we have a lot more to do, and we need to get the mechanisms in place to support women. I think what's more important and probably most crucial is that we get to the cause of the underlying, which is the terrible rape culture, and we try and sort that out.
Society does not support women when they speak about sexual assault, because then most of the time the people who are supposed to support those who speak out, they have their own problems and would rather deal with their own problems, and then most of the women can't seek help from the justice system because the justice system is always too slow to respond, and then they just end up giving up.
I do believe that society does care when women get sexually assaulted. Social media is such a big thing nowadays that naming and shaming a person will get them sent to prison pretty quickly.
Sex is something that is supposed to be done in secrecy. There are a section of women who are also not very nice. They are as men. And in that case, whenever there are issues of women claiming to have been assaulted by men, it becomes an issue that nobody would get a clear picture about it.
Society has actually left the women aside a little bit. This is because there are some cultural anomalies, rather beliefs, that actually view the sexual matters, rather statements, as very secretive things that actually should not be shared.
The society views a situation where a woman is complaining of sexual harassment, that she's the one on the wrong, that she's the one who is most of the time mischievous or doing the wrong thing. Yeah. So usually the society will look down upon the woman who is complaining about sexual harassment. And yes, because there are certain rights groups that are trying to champion the rights of the woman in terms of voicing issues around sexual harassment. So we have sections of society that are supporting the woman in championing their sexual harassment issues, but on the other side, we have the larger society that is largely patriarchal and does not support the woman when they raise the issues of sexual harassment.
And we're going to take a short break here on Straight Talk Africa. When we come back, we'll look at the power of the global Me Too movement and its many versions in African countries. We'll look at what's needed to eradicate victim blaming and bring perpetrators of sexual violence and harassment to justice. We'll be back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're watching Straight Talk Africa on VOA. Welcome back. American activist Tarana Burke first coined the phrase Me Too in 2006 to help black women share their stories of sexual trauma. Back then, Burke had doubts whether Me Too would catch on, but it did. Let's take a closer look at the movement and how it has helped survivors of sexual harassment and abuse hold some of America's most powerful men to account.
In 2017, the Me Too hashtag turned into a global phenomenon, a rallying cry against sexual abuse and assault for women across the Americas, Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and Europe. It also brought global attention to other versions of the worldwide social movement as protesters called for perpetrators to be brought to justice. The potency of the movement was perhaps best seen with high-profile trials in Hollywood, as dozens of survivors stepped forward to reveal years of sexual abuse by some of the industry's most powerful men. Movie mogul Harvey Weinstein was convicted for rape and sexual assault. He is now serving a 23-year prison sentence. In 2018, comedian and actor Bill Cosby was convicted of aggravated assault and sentenced to 3 to 10 years in prison. However, he was freed in June after his conviction was vacated by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania for violations of Cosby's Fifth Amendment and 14th Amendment due process rights. As Cosby walked out of prison, another entertainment icon faced multiple allegations of sexual abuse spanning decades.
Robert said, "Don't believe everything you hear."
R. Kelly has been charged with multiple counts of sexual assault.
In an explosive documentary, sexual assault survivors recounted how R&B superstar R. Kelly preyed on teenaged girls.
Black women had been talking about this story since 1991.
America has not held abusers accountable.
This is us, America. This is us letting this happen.
I know the names of 48 women whose lives Kelly has ruined. 48 women can't be lying.
Yo, tell me with this!
In September, Kelly was convicted of sex trafficking and racketeering. He's awaiting sentencing and faces separate charges of sex abuse and child pornography. Tarana Burke says Kelly's conviction was a long time coming and offers survivors hope.
I think that there is some relief that they're raising their voices mattered, right? Because I think for a lot of people who have come forward, both in this case and outside of this case, only to have it fall on deaf ears or not be believed or not see a conviction, right? Which is why we try to encourage people not to put their eggs in the basket of a conviction, like not to seek healing from the outcome of a court case, because it's just, you just can't control it.
Burke has penned a highly personal memoir of her childhood in New York City, her journey into activism, and the beginnings of Me Too. The book contains a heart-wrenching account of how a man raped her at the age of 7 and how that profoundly shaped her future.
Shame is, it's all-consuming, right? It can get into all the nooks and crannies and cracks and crevices of your life. And if there's not something that's put in place to expose it, right, for what it is, which is a lie. And I didn't have that. And a lot of people, young, old, black, white, a lot of people just don't have that. There's not enough messages that say this is not your shame to carry.
Before the Me Too era and social media, American lawyer Anita Hill blazed a momentous trail for women. In 1991, she publicly accused Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment in televised testimony before an all-male Senate Judiciary Committee. Hill says she saw history repeat itself in 2018 when academic Christine Blasey Ford accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault. But just like Thomas decades before him, Kavanaugh secured a lifelong appointment to America's highest court.
I wish that I had known that the work would take a long time and that I should be patient. I should be diligent, but patient. That's what I wish I had known. I actually thought that it could be done, you know, relatively quickly, because if we had the right processes in place, you know, as a lawyer, we think that's all there is to it. But what I wasn't understanding was that our culture of denial of the harm that gender violence is causing has been built into those systems.
Hill released a book recently titled Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. She says the COVID-19 lockdowns presented an opportunity to recount her experiences and those of other survivors of sexual abuse.
There was this urgency to have a reckoning, actually, some sense of accountability for where we are with gender violence. I think that was confirmed when, in the very early days of the pandemic, intimate partner violence just surged. And so that was the confirmation, really, that this was time for the book. And people were ready to deal with hard questions.
Well, to discuss the impact of the global Me Too movement, I spoke to Nasu Fofana, an author, entrepreneur, and women's rights activist in Sierra Leone, and Rosebel Kagumire, a Ugandan activist and the editor of the platform African Feminism. I asked Fofana and Kagumire how they see the global Me Too movement and whether it serves the interests of Africa's women.
Thank you, Heidi. You know, it's very important to recognize that the movement is the women themselves. So the movement is not someone outside doing this work for us. We are the movement. African women have had their Me Too movements from time to time, every day. Growing up as a girl in Uganda, I knew stories of rape. I knew stories of sexual abuse. I experienced sexual harassment from the community to workplaces. These are our realities. But I think that the Me Too movement, as seen maybe from the mainstream global stage, which we would be talking about, is how then in the recent years, we have seen powerful voices captured in the media. And for the first time, the media actually paying a bit of attention, seeing a bit of a shift. And this is from decades and decades of work from women like Anita Hill, from women from very many conflicts across Africa that have been moving countries and governments and saying our lives matter. And that's how we have certain protocols on this continent that talk about sexual abuse, sexual violence. And so this is not in a vacuum. We are not coming to jump on some Western something happening. This is very well located within our lives, and we have experienced this. We have been at the heart of this movement, both from our grandmother's time to our mother's time to our lives right now.
And of course, to your point, Rosebell, there has been this generational awareness in African countries. It might not have been Me Too. I mean, when I was younger, and I'm not going to give away my age here, but it was some other movement by another name. Nasu, in recent years, we've seen End Rape Culture, that campaign in South Africa, the My Dress, My Choice in Kenya, and if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Nopi Wuma, or the I Will Not Shut Up campaign in Senegal, and other movements that did not necessarily flow from Me Too, but that originated in Africa, right?
I believe the difference that we're seeing here is because of access to media, access to the platforms. So like my sister Joy said, this, you know, we've been doing this all our lives, whether it's our grandmothers, but you also have to look at our history, where a lot of African countries, or in my region, have gone through civil war. And it is noted, it is there, that sexual violence, you know, in conflict is a very, very big issue. So this issue has been around us. It's not that women have not been talking. So if you look at the situation of Sierra Leone during the Civil War, we had women who went to traditional leaders, you know, in safe spaces for women and discussed the affordances. They would not sit in the media today like you and I are doing to speak about their experiences. So it has been organic. It has been there. But of course, the culture of silence, the way it's been viewed in society, the stigma makes it difficult for women, regardless of their socio-political status, to actually speak. So what has that done? It has normalized the experiences. It has made it feel like it's okay for your body to be violated, whether it's during war or it's during peacetime or it's in your bedroom. So it is very, very difficult for people to speak, because we don't have not only the kind of media access, but also the support system, okay? It is okay if you're wealthy in a Western country to come out and speak. You have agency to a certain level. It's the reverse in my society. When I spoke up about my experience of being a rape victim at 15, in 2019, I spoke first in 2016, but then, you know, I did not call my perpetrator's name. When I did that in 2019, my country erupted. Why? I was not supposed to be a woman who should speak about being violated. I was a former special advisor to the president. I am influential in my society. Young women look up to me. So that access, that platform, definitely made a lot of people uncomfortable. Yes, I had massive support online, obviously, because it was on social media. But I also had a backlash from a few people who trumpeted that. I was enjoying the sex. I was lying. I wanted fame. I wanted people to know me, you know. But I spoke. So in my culture, in Sierra Leone, even as we speak, even though now people are, you know, young women, people are speaking about this issue, but there's still a lot to do. What we don't have is the support system, okay, whether it's counseling, whether it's money to hire lawyers, whether it's forensic and machines, all of these things that women in the, you know, in the West have, that maybe they take for granted. They can just walk into a hospital, they can have all of these services. We don't have that. So how we prove our cases is a lot more difficult. Apart from culture, but just the access to certain amenities, certain services, makes it difficult for women in my society to talk about their experiences.
And as Nasu is referring there to this economic or class divide when it comes to access to justice and the media, Rosebell, do you see it playing out that way on the African continent in the work that you do? And also in terms of who is believed, who gets justice and who gets access to justice?
Definitely. We need to recognize that sexual abuse and sexual violence does not happen in a vacuum. It happens in certain contexts. And economic context also can help you maybe prevent escape certain violence in a certain way, but it is not the only factor. It doesn't mean that if you're from a wealthy family, you'll not be a victim of sexual abuse, because sexual abuse is actually happening right in our homes, fathers raping their children. So even economically, sometimes it cannot protect you. Even if you found a country where women are a bit in a middle, certain middle class, it has not alleviated sexual abuse, because we have marital rape, we have your cousins raping you. It is a social cultural issue, very, very, very ingrained in patriarchal societies. Like we heard from Nasu, the reality is that the silencing is invested in the fact that if we spoke, then you can see the face of the perpetrator. The face of a perpetrator for a long time has been hidden. We could hear a woman speak about her experience, but we did not know who did it. You know, the society is very invested from your family. It silences you to never say that name. So as long as perpetrators are protected, it doesn't matter how much victims speak out or survivors speak out. If you continue to invest heavily in protecting men, and I'm saying men because we know that sexual abuse, where victims are men, the perpetrators, over 90% are men. So we must address the issue head on. We can no longer sugarcoat who is responsible for this mass violation of women, not only just women, but also sexual minorities in our societies, you know? So that's why I'm saying money is not the only factor. And we have to see what compounds this problem is that you have the religion, you have the house and culture, you have the media and the law, and you have the state structure. All these things work together to reinforce silence, to make sure that even if you came out to speak, yes, Patty, that's why our laws do not encourage us to be able to access justice in a fully way that you can actually, as a victim, they are not victim-centered. It's about just ticking off another violation, another crime has been committed, right? So, but if we were very important, it's only now that many African countries are bringing up the issue of having a perpetrator list so that we know who did this. But for a long time, a man could violate as many women and move to another locality or even stay in the same place. We would never know. But we have to continue to understand that this is sexual abuse is happening in a dynamic where there's very power imbalance, gendered power imbalance. Women are denied power right from home, from school, to everywhere. In many ways, in Africa, it's even worse because it is colonized power. Our laws are colonial. Everything, we have dismantled systems, cultural systems that could have protected women and children. So we have to remember all these class, but also other factors like sexuality, gender identity, that make other people's lives even much worse, that they would not even be able to, the small room that we can have probably as cisgendered women to discuss, that so many people would not actually even have that space because their lives are criminalized. Our societies are hell-bent on silencing their identity like they don't exist.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll bring you more from my conversation with women's rights activists Nasu Fofana and Rosevel Kagumire. We'll also show you how survivors of sexual abuse by priests are calling for historic reforms in the Catholic Church. Stay with us. We'll have all that and more when Straight Talk Africa returns.
Amended the Sexual Offences Act, and now it is the punitive measures are stricter. We've set up courts, special courts for that. We have special centres, one-stop centres to deal with rape and other issues.
And that was the president of Sierra Leone, Julius Maada Bio, speaking to my colleague Peter Clotty in Washington about his government's efforts to toughen penalties for sex crimes and protect women and girls. And the ways sexual violence is addressed and prosecuted in African countries is part of my conversation with rights activist Nasu Fofana, who is from Sierra Leone, and Uganda's Rosebel Kagumire. I want to get to this issue of the law. Now, in my home country of South Africa, we have beautiful, very good-looking laws. On paper, the country looks progressive, in step with the times. Women look empowered more so than ever before. But on the streets and behind closed doors, it's a different story in terms of how those laws are enforced. And when you find women's dead bodies turn up in bushes. Nasu, in your country of Sierra Leone, what is it like to engage with the law for someone who wishes to come forward and report sexual abuse and assault? What is the journey of reporting a crime like that? What is that like?
Well, first and foremost, the higher percentage of our victims are minors. Okay, so they are mostly children below the age of 18. So obviously, they need the parents and, of course, the states to help them through the process. One thing that we really, really know that makes it frustrating for victims from the time they go to the police, especially the police, that your first point of contact within our system, within the context of Sierra Leone, which is the family support units within the police, is the least funded division of the Sierra Leone police. The first point of a victim's, contact with the law is a police station that is mostly sometimes filthy. There are other people. The issue of confidentiality is almost not there. You go there, they are not equipped. They don't have computers to even take proper records. They have to rely on, sometimes their own personal resources. So when a victim walks into, we call them the FSU, you are seated in this place where sometimes people in the next room can actually hear what you're saying. Okay, so you've gone there for some kind of safety or justice. But what you start seeing immediately is people will know, oh, it's that woman or that girl who they raped. Because of social media, the moment something happens, now it's all over. So most of the time, by the time you're there, the media is there, people are there. So you're already recognized. After that, after your reports, they're giving you a medical paper to go to the Rainbow Initiative, which is a referral organization which I work with. I'm one of the family members. I'm actually going to step out after 9 years. So they give a medical certificate that comes back to the police, and the police will then use that to do further investigation and then send the case to the law officers department in the Ministry of Justice to get advice whether to charge or not to charge. Now, that is when things are going smooth. Most families or most victims don't have the money sometimes to go back and forth during this process. And when it gets to court, the time that it takes, okay, through the investigation, of course, we don't have a forensic lab, so proving rape is a huge issue. It's your word, most times against somebody else's word. And so the strenuous activities that that survivors go through, sometimes they just get discouraged. They just get discouraged and leave the case. We now have sexual offenses courts, okay? But there's so much backlog and just this amount of judges to sit on these cases. So even with that step, it's also underfunded. So for victims and survivors, the road, we have all these structures being set, but we don't have the investment We don't even have data to inform certain decisions. We don't have experts. We don't have psychologists here that can go into court to actually even look at the psychological impact. So victims will face perpetrators in open court. Now these days, I mean, there's some psychosocial counseling, but you need so much more to be able to face somebody in a court of law. Investigating sexual violence from the beginning really works against victims and survivors. So most people, unfortunately, walk out and just stay back and see what happens and say, we left with KSP God. We leave it in the hands of God Almighty.
I want to touch on this issue of shame around sexual violence and who has to carry the weight of it and the responsibility of proving what happened and women not being believed in society and in their families and in their communities and in their countries. We see this all the time. Rosebell, you've spoken about this in the media, that the shame and the stigma still falls on the survivor and not on the perpetrator.
Definitely, this is a very big challenge. And for me, it comes back to power. For a long time, when you as a social group have been dispossessed of the place in society to be seen as knowers. Imagine in a society, in any day when you walk in any country, who surrounds you? It's men. So every day on TV, we tell our society that believe men, they are the ones who know. If a man does not back up your story, it doesn't have even to be about sexual abuse, they're not gonna believe you. You have to prove yourself every day that you know something. So then imagine from that disbelief that a woman knows and she's telling the truth, the idea that a woman is a liar and all these stereotypes that have been put on women to prevent them to step into the public discourse. It's about control. It's about who controls the public discourse, who has the power to be seen as knowledgeable, intelligent, and believable. It extends to that. So when that meets the control, that control of public discourse, it meets this idea of the you need to control women's bodies. You know, it is rooted in that. Men have enough room and entitlement to do whatever they want. But if a woman defends themselves even a little bit, even you speaking back, you're not supposed to speak back. It's about control of voice or who occupies which space in society. So for me, we cannot just be about only sexual abuse, because this is actually a symptom of greater power imbalance and control and abuse and subjugation of women and minorities in our countries. We live in a very hierarchical society that, you know, ageist society. If you're a young person, you cannot even claim to know anything. So as a young person, when something happens to you, you have nobody to trust. Because the first thing they're going to blame you, the first question is, where are you going? I told you. So we have adapted as a society of this power imbalance and abuse in a very mode of protection, but it's not working. Because we think if we tell a girl, don't sit properly, don't dress this way, don't walk at night, we think that's protection. It is not. We have not told men how to behave and how to be accountable and to be held accountable to the things they do to women. Until we do that, no matter how much we tell women to behave or sit or dress, occupy which space and go separate them, I don't know, we are not going to achieve anything. So that's, for me, that's where it is. We have to see this as great as how gender power was really toppled in our communities because of colonization. And creating a hierarchy where you have a man at the top and the rest of the people should be quiet. And that has not always been like that. We had communal approaches and communal courts everywhere on this continent, you know, where people could be heard, people from different places. But we are still using the colonial approaches to our living, and it's not working. And it's not working because the colonial state we have inherited is a violent state. Even where you're going, you're trying to get justice, is already violent. I have a friend who was assaulted, and she went to report. And the same police officer who was supposed to be taking her statement was like, was already sexually harassing her. You know, the sexual harassment that happens to victims of sexual abuse, it's insane, you know? It happens. Once you speak out, it's not just a story of one man assaulting you. It's many men looking to assault you. That's how sick we are as societies, you know? And this is happening in person. And with the internet, it's even worse. You know, it's even worse. We are seeing all sorts of forms of silencing of women, using women's pictures, you know, non-consensual sharing of women's pictures, you know, using nudity as a tool to silence. It is an extension of all forms of sexual abuse. So we need to be looking at that layer of how much voice do women have in society? How much space do they occupy? We might tick off this whole gendered, you know, index. We have these women in parliament, but it does not translate to the realities of women. So we need to be serious about dismantling patriarchy and making sure that our discourse, our power is more balanced, that people, all people in our communities have a chance to speak back. You had 2019 when this young woman was killed in Cape Town, you know, raped and killed. We had very many protests, you know. Namibia, you know, last year during COVID, young Namibians were on the streets, shut it all down. We have had these. We have had in Nigeria, Market Women's March in Nigeria. We have had church too in Nigeria where people are demonstrating against a pastor. All these movements are happening because I think young people are occupying more space than before, and they are more daring to say we are here and we are going to challenge the systems, the colonial and cultural systems like never before. But freedom for women on this continent is not the same as men's freedom. So we need to understand, to situate this issue within the struggle, the largest struggle for women's liberation on this continent, and finding a voice and restoring, finding the rightful place that is equal and just in the society.
Nasu, what in your view needs to change about the way sexual abuse is prosecuted, even referred to and talked about in our communities and in countries across the continent?
Well, I mean, like I said in the first instance, I think we have theoretical commitments, but we actually don't have, you know, the emotional commitments to support victims or survivors from the state level to the home level. Okay, so it's a very fanciful discussion for a lot of people because it makes them look good. So from that far extent point, you will hear all the flowery conversations and laws. When we're discussing about this, you should look in the room and see who are the decision makers within that space. So the fact that they don't give the platform and space for women to take the decisions within this particular topic, you know that it's a structural way of silencing women. So when women like us, with a certain platform come out, we have a lot more coming at us. But women like us have to connect with women like my sister and other women so we can have that support system at not only at the national level, but at the continental level. We share our stories. We form the coalition. What is lacking is having survivors with the experience of this trauma to be able to be leading these conversations. So I feel like what also we need to bring into the conversation as women, but most importantly as survivors, is solution-focused conversations. There are men who believe our stories. There are women, no matter what you do, who don't believe other women's stories. So the conversation, in this conversation as well, we need to have those men, and we have quite a few, who challenge and hold other men accountable. And we should also challenge those women who try to diminish our experiences because they are playing to a particular gallery. And so they are used as tools and strategies to silence other women. We must confront these women who make our stories look not believable at all.
And a big thank you to Nasu Fofana in Sierra Leone and Rosebel Kagumire in Dakar, Senegal, for sharing their experiences and perspectives with me on this very important subject. It is much appreciated. Survivors of sexual abuse by priests in France are calling for historic reforms of the Catholic Church after an independent commission found that hundreds of thousands of children had suffered systematic abuse over the past 7 decades. We get this story from Henry Ridgewell.
Jean-René, Jean-François and Joseph were around 10 years old when the abuse began. Priests at the Chavagne-en-Paye Seminary for Minors in western France engaged in systematic sexual abuse against the children in their charge.
When the idea came to them, they would come and get us. I haven't seen you for a long time. Come on. And they would take us to their rooms.
The Catholic Church covered up the abuse.
When someone, a priest, behaved too scandalously in one place, whether in the seminary or in the parish, the bishop would move him to a parish where he would do exactly the same thing he had done before.
For decades, such horrifying stories of abuse and cover-up were repeated across France. The commission findings, published Monday, revealed that at least 216,000 children, mostly boys, were abused by up to 3,200 priests and other clerics since 1950. When abuse by lay members of the church is included, the number of victims is estimated at 330,000.
Above all, there was a series of neglects, failures, silence, and institutional cover-up, which were systemic in nature.
Pope Francis, Tuesday, offered this response to the commission findings.
Numeri considerevoli.
I would like to express to the victims my sadness, sorrow for the trauma that they have suffered, and also my shame, our shame, my shame, for the Church's too long inability to put them at the center of its concerns.
Under French law, many of the offences are too old to prosecute. The Commission called for the Church to increase financial compensation to the victims, payments which are scheduled to begin next year. Some victims say the Catholic Church itself must undergo historic reform.
Aujourd'hui, une réforme de l'Église à vivre.
This involves a process of profound change in the practices, relationships, and governance of the Church.
Earlier this year, Pope Francis changed Catholic laws to explicitly criminalize sexual abuse. Amici Pelisse de Rosas heads the group Catholic Voices in France.
I think as long as you have one case left, one predator, one victim left, you need to do more. But Pope Francis, be that as it may, I think has really begun a culture of change.
The French Commission follows similar investigations in several other countries, including the United States and Australia. Pope Francis has described sexual abuse within the Catholic Church as a worldwide catastrophe. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you to all my guests and thank you to all my VOA colleagues who contributed to this week's edition of Straight Talk Africa. And thank you for always watching and always listening. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.